This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And we are at the beginning of flu season. And, you know, I've been boasting, about getting my flu and COVID shots this last weekend. And I want to remind people that the RSV vaccine is now covered in Ontario for people over the age of 75. And I want to ask the panel, in terms of symptoms, is there some way to tell if a patient is coming down with RSV versus the flu or COVID? If they're showing symptoms, how do you tell the difference between those respiratory illnesses? And if you need painkillers that have oxycodone in them, there's a shortage. And the word is that it will last into the new year. How many people will that affect? The good news is that other medications that include codeine, which were on shortage, are now back in stock. And that includes Tylenol 3. There's also Tylenol 2 and Tylenol 4. I'm not even sure what those things are used for. We'll find out. And also, we are just reading about a new treatment for, I would say, the most intractable cancer. It's certainly up there, pancreatic cancer. We'll talk about that as well. If you have questions, comments, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center, former head of BC Cancer, Dr. Fahad Razak, general internist at St. Michael's Hospital and Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the U of T, and Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing here in Toronto. Hi, and welcome, everyone.
Hi, Libby.
Okay, I would like to start with RSV. Again, we reminded people that you can now get it and it would be covered, even though if you want to pay outside of those age groups, you can. But is there a way to tell the difference in those respiratory illnesses if you're coming down with it or in the absence of a test? Elisa?
So you're correct. It becomes difficult in the absence of a test, and it's very difficult right now to even to get a COVID, to do a rapid test for a COVID for a virus. So generally, a flu influenza will prevent more with the onset of the illness. Will be you'll develop a high fever, chills, aches. You'll have really bad fatigue, and RSV will start more like a mild cold that will then progress. So that's the basis. It becomes very hard for me as within the community to determine what it is. And oftentimes we have to just treat based on symptoms. So if somebody came in and said they thought they have RSV, there would actually be no way that I would be able to confirm that they had that diagnosis.
Really?
But it would generally, yeah.
So is there a test for it that you just don't have access to, or there's no test for it?
So generally what happens is when people go to a hospital and emerge, they'll run a panel and it will check for many different viruses. And that's usually how we determine whether or not what the virus is that you would have. There's some family doctors who will be part of a community surveillance program where they'll submit swabs that will be for influenza that will help to determine what the rates of flu are. But for me, where I practice, there would be no confirmatory test that I could run at the time.
Wow. Fahad, what is the very beginning of the flu season? What's it been like where you are so far?
Yeah, not seeing a lot of cases yet. In fact, I'm going on service, clinical service tomorrow, and I just took in over a team from my colleague of about 20 to 30 patients, and there's not a single case. So, and that's not surprising. We're in November. The peak and onset can start in November, but that's rare. It tends to be a little bit later. We've had a number of years where we're really seeing cases surge in December, January. And so this is a very good time for people to go and get your protection. And again, just as a reminder, the reason why we say update annually for flu and for COVID is because the version of the virus that circulates each year is different. And so what we're giving you is protection to our best ability against the version that's going to cause problems that season. And sometimes that our ability to match is very, very good. Sometimes it's less good, but in any event, it's providing you a base level of protection as you go into the respiratory virus season.
What has the early indication be from, people in the other hemisphere, from Australia and places like that, of the type of flu season it'll be?
Yeah, so right now it's looking bad. The Australian evidence suggests a very, very bad flu season. And that does have some important prediction for what happens here. It's not always one-to-one. It's not exactly, if it's terrible there, it's terrible here, but it tends to correlate pretty well. And so I think that is a warning to us that the match and the severity could be very bad this year in Canada. And so getting vaccinated becomes doubly important. And for flu vaccines, remember, it's everyone over the age of 6 months. We're talking about essentially all Canadians or all Ontarians are eligible for this. And in less than 6 months, it's just because the body, the infant's immune system is not ready to respond to the vaccine. So this is really all of Ontario, all of Canada vaccine. And I would strongly recommend people get it. I've gotten it. My family's gotten it. I recommend it for all my patients.
Interesting. First of all, before I ask the next question about the flu vaccine, what in particular do any of you know, what in particular is making this season in places like Australia very bad? Is there a particular reason?
Yeah, so it has to do with, I can offer an answer. It has to do with, so we use technical terms for the version of the virus. We use these terms where we describe the H number and the N number. And there's different ranges of the H, H1, H2, H3, and there's different ranges of the N, N1, N2, N3, et cetera. Every year, some combination of those things happen. So let's say we're talking about avian influenza, that's H5N1. It looks like right now there's an emergence of a combination of the H's and the N's, which is not as well recognized by our historical immunity. So in other words, if a combination of those comes through that our body recognizes right away, well, good, we have strong protection. So let's say it was very close to a flu season from 2 or 3 years ago, many people would have some residual protection against it. But if it looks very different than one that we've had in the recent years, then that causes a more severe season. So those are some of the factors that are at play here. And it looks like, for whatever reason this year, the combination that came through in the Southern Hemisphere, a lot of people had severe reactions to it.
Malcolm, there's a shortage of oxycodone. Those kinds of medications are used a lot for cancer patients. How dire is that?
Well, I don't want to minimize it, but the reality is for my population, we're often dealing with fairly severe pain. So there are lots of other drugs that we can use. And there is a dosage equivalency between the different narcotics, oxycodone, codeine, dilaudid, morphine, so that interchanging, it's inconvenient, but it can be done. And as long as there are other drugs available, it's usually quite manageable. The other thing is that if you're dealing with these fixed dose combinations, like Tylenol 3 is 325 milligrams of acetaminophen, 30 milligrams of codeine, it's the combination ones where the shortage exists. And in that case, you can just use acetaminophen by itself and codeine by itself. So I think it's a manageable issue, honestly. The challenge in this particular context is that there's a lot of people who are taking these drugs. So there's lots of drug shortages, and we may talk more about this, but when you're dealing with a fairly common medication, obviously the impact is more troubling than if it's a drug that's used by very few people.
When it comes to those oxy drugs, there's a big addiction problem. I don't know if that's relevant for people in very severe cancer pain, but do any of these combinations or lack thereof affect that?
Well, so the context is, and I think everyone would agree, that overprescribing of certain narcotics for chronic pain was a significant contributing factor in the whole overdose epidemic. I think oxycodone, particularly long-acting oxycodone, was one of the major contributors to that because it was promoted for chronic non-malignant pain. With the Tylenol 3s and stuff, less of an issue, I think. But generally, I think people are now more cautious with the use of narcotics, particularly for chronic non-malignant pain, because of the impact of the overdose crisis. So I think this shortage was not driven by the fact that they're being more commonly used. It's more like the usual cause of drug shortages, which is manufacturing problems, supply chain problems, which is usually the reason for these drug shortages.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Ron in Guelph. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for taking my call. So my pharmacist gave me the two vaccines, the COVID vaccine and the high-dosed one, and I asked him about the Shingrix vaccine for shingles, and he said, you better sit down. And he says, well, I'm already sitting down. He says, it costs you money. I said, why would it cost me money? I'm over 75. He says, that's the problem. The Ontario government only funds the Shingrix vaccine for people between the ages 65 and 70. And I don't understand the logic in that at all.
It's a government regulation. I don't know where logic plays into it. Alisa, is that a problem for your patient population?
So cost can be a barrier. So when the original shingles vaccine came out, it was never covered. And then when the Shingrix vaccine, which is the only commercially available vaccine that we have now, became available, people originally still had to pay. And then what the government does is they do a cost-benefit analysis, and what they determined was that it became most effective from a cost-benefit analysis that they would vaccinate people between the ages of 65 and 69. So the vaccine is actually licensed from the ages of 50 and above. And so oftentimes people will ask for the vaccine once they turn 50 or in their 50s, because everybody is aware of somebody that they know in their life who had shingles and what is the implications and the pain that's associated with it. So Ron, the caller, is correct. It's only available between 65 and to 69, and anybody outside of those age groups is actually responsible for paying for the cost themselves.
Uh-huh. We've talked about those cost-benefit analyses before. Fahad, Malcolm mentioned that he thinks people are more careful with the drugs that have fueled the overdose crisis because of all the news about it. Do you find that in your particular patient population?
Yeah, we talk about it a lot, I have to say. Like, I'm at one of the teaching hospitals, and so we have, you know, the medical students and the residents and the fellows with us. And opioid safety is something we talk about a lot. And the role of physicians as being one of the critical mechanisms by which opioid dependence develops. So there's really good evidence from the United States that physicians who prescribe more of these medications, these opioid medications for well-reasoned causes, let's say you have an arm fracture or you have pancreatitis or something that's very painful. But if you're more likely to prescribe those medications, then your patients, just by luck of the fact that they saw you in the emergency room or they were admitted to you in the hospital, your patients become more likely to develop opioid use disorder. Remember, there's a strong genetic susceptibility part to this. And so You know, after I had hip surgery, I took some opioids and it had almost no effect on me. That's because, you know, for whatever reason, I don't have the right receptors to feel the benefit from it, where someone else may feel significant benefit and some of the high that comes from it. And so there's a strong genetic element, and physicians who are prescribing at high volumes, you're going to end up prescribing to some people who are very susceptible to becoming dependent. And so we've taught a lot around this. We review all the doses we give out. We give limited numbers of doses. We don't give refills. So we're doing what we can on our side, but certainly it is a work in progress.
Okay. Malcolm, I've just looked up the name of this drug, but there is apparently a promising trial of a drug for pancreatic cancer, which has been your specialty. It's called daraxonrasib. Small trial.
Right. So this is, you know, we have to be cautious, right, because this is preliminary data. But this is quite an exciting drug, to be honest. So the background here is that there is a specific genetic mutation strongly associated with pancreatic cancer. The technical name is called a KRAS mutation. And it's been very hard to develop drugs which target this particular mutation. And we're now seeing a few of these drugs that have been developed, and this one is one of the lead ones. So there's a biological basis for thinking that this might work in pancreatic cancer. And we're doing some studies of Princess Margaret, and the preliminary evidence is quite encouraging because this is, as you know, Libby, this is a very difficult cancer to treat, and the response to any sort of standard chemotherapy tends to be quite short-lived, and they're quite toxic. So having what we call targeted therapy, which specifically focuses on this mutation, makes a lot of scientific sense. And as I said, it's not just this drug, but there are a few other similar drugs in trials. And the initial results have been pretty encouraging. Having said that, you know, until we do a proper phase 3 trial, which is being done, where this drug is compared to the current standard therapy, we won't know for sure. But I think we haven't had a lot of excitement in this area for a long time. So I think this is legitimately encouraging.
So what I'm reading here is that initially in a trial that involved 83 patients over 16 months, and this is pancreatic cancer that had spread. So for 16 months, 90% of them saw no tumor growth, which is quite amazing, I think.
It is. And the real issue is how long this effect will last, because our experience with some of these drugs which target mutations is that cancer is continually evolving and often can develop resistance to these targeted drugs that target mutations. So I think what's going to be important is how long does this control of the tumor last for? And obviously the longer it is, the more clinically meaningful it'll be.
Now, the other question is, my understanding is that KRAS, the mutation, is a driver in quite a few cancers, not just pancreatic. Is that right?
That's true. I would say pancreatic is the one that probably more than 90% of pancreatic cancers have a KRAS mutation. But you're right. It is seen in other tumors. And what we've learned from other drugs which target mutations is that often if they work well in one disease, they will also work well in other diseases which have similar mutations. So there's a lot of interest. This is a common genetic mutation in cancer. And so there's a lot of interest in these drugs.
Interesting. That's very good news. And speaking of good news, there is one thing, Fahad, in the budget, the federal budget that we've seen before, sort of locally, certainly from philanthropy at Princess Margaret. And there's, I think, $1.5 billion, I forget over how many years, to recruit physicians, I guess, mostly from the states. What do you make of that? They refer to it as top talent. So I guess the question is, what do you call top talent?
Yeah, so what I saw, I don't know if we're referring to the same thing, Libby. I saw dedicated money, I think it was approximately $1.5 billion, for top research talent. Like, in other words, to recruit academics from the United States into Canada. I think that is very positive. This is a generational opportunity to bring in talent that, you know, frankly, is extremely unhappy and with the direction of the United States and where their research and other funding is under threat. However, the budget also had a 2% cut to research funding, which means that the talent that you're recruiting, remember, we are also one of the lowest per capita funders of research in the G7. So if you're recruiting talent to do research and innovation, but you don't have resources to do research and innovation, that talent may leave the country very quickly. So I just think that they have to think about the resources required to support that talent. And again, as someone who lived in the United States for 5 years, it's jarring to see how much lower the resources were once I moved back to Canada to do research, innovation, studies, to do work, to do the research work that is what I do in my career. And we have lost, but there's a dramatic example. We recruited someone from MIT who was one of the top 40 researchers in health artificial intelligence. And she left after 2 years just because the resource and other structural problems in Canada made it hard for her to do her work.
The first thing that we heard about was, I think, $50 million through philanthropy at Princess Margaret to do the same. I think that one was targeted for early stage research. But a general sense, Malcolm, how is the recruiting going? Because in the past, often we hear a lot of people stateside saying, can't take this, I'm going to leave. But then they really don't.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would reiterate what Fahad said, which is that as a nation compared to Britain and the U.S. particularly, we the government funds much less research and we rely much more heavily on philanthropy. Fortunately, at Princess Margaret, we have a good foundation. And I don't want to be too parochial because it is a worldwide search, but a lot of good, bright, talented young Canadians who want to get into research, it's a really tough career path at the moment. And I think we also need to think about how do we enhance opportunities for young researchers in Canada to allow them to stay here and not have to go to the States to further their careers.
And Alisa, we were talking previously about recruiting family doctors. The government has created some more family health teams. You've been talking about trying to hire a nurse practitioner. So how is that side of the recruitment equation going?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, I don't think we've found a nurse practitioner yet. And I think this has been ongoing. We were successful in the first call when they expanded the family health teams in May, and really we haven't been able to move forward as a group because we don't have the nurse practitioner or the physician assistant. So it might be the issue that there might be availability and spots that are now opening up that never existed before, and now there's just not the resources, the human resources to find people to work within primary care. So it will be very interesting to see how things play out, but we're still waiting and we don't have anybody yet.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, Dr. Alisa Naiman, Dr. Fahad Razak, and Dr. Malcolm Moore. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Excellent.
Okay. We are taking that break. When we come back, we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of the federal budget, particularly as it affects older Canadians. There's one report came out right after very well-respected C.D. Howe Institute that said seniors are actually the hardest hit. When we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, many Zoomers were very worried heading into the federal budget, what with the government talking about generational change, generational investments, and increasing airtime for those fomenting intergenerational strife by blaming boomers and other older Canadians for our fiscal mess. But as soon as the budget came out, the prestigious C.D. Howe Institute came out with its own study, its own analysis, declaring that seniors are actually the hardest hit because of changes to the tax code. So, people, what do you think of that? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. It is kind of complicated. So here to break it down, we have Anthony Quinn, president of CARP, David Rotfleisch, a Canadian lawyer and chartered accountant, and Moshe Lander, senior lecturer in economics at Concordia University in Montreal. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Libby.
Hello.
Hi, Libby. Good to be back.
Thank you. Anthony and I have been seeing a lot of each other the last few days.
Busy time during the budget.
A special time during the budget. So, my take on this is it's good that the C.D. Howe Institute is, we just keep hearing so much from these people who are sort of blame the boomers, they get too much from the government. But there's this report, not all of it new, that says actually not.
No, the C.D. Howe Institute is really trying, and I don't want to speak for them, but everything they've put out in the last number of years has been cautioning the Canadian government about economic policies that harm the labor workforce. And they understand that older Canadians play an important part in Canada's economy going forward, and they will have to continue maintaining a part of that workforce. And what they're pointing out in this report is that if you are a retiree or someone past typical retirement age who collects the GIS because you have the guaranteed income supplement, and you want to work a little bit to continue to increase your income, you get severely punished by taxes, and that disincentivizes you to continue to work. So that's bad for the economy, and it's bad for the individual seniors.
Mm-hmm. And Moshe, there's this business about the way that happens are changes that either change the threshold for being eligible for a program like the Guaranteed Income Supplement and the threshold where it's clawed back, right?
That's exactly it. And so what happens is, let's say that the threshold is $50,000 to make up a fake number. If the government says that the threshold is now $40,000, then anything earned between $40,000 and $50,000 now is going to start to be clawed back, where before it would have been entirely kept. The other thing that they can do too is, if we want to keep the threshold at $50,000, let's say, but instead of clawing back 50 cents on every additional dollar earned, we want to increase it to 60 cents on every additional dollar earned. This is effectively like an increase in the tax rate of 10 percentage points, right? Remember that when the government is collecting taxes, effectively what they're doing is they're saying every time that you earn a dollar, we're going to take a portion of it for ourselves. So in a clawback situation, they're just saying that every extra dollar you earn beyond that threshold, we're going to take an extra 10 cents of that dollar that we weren't before. So it can fall disproportionately then on people at that lower level of income. And people that are reliant on government programs to help support them. And so, of course, both of these are speaking to seniors that are one foot in retirement and one foot still in the work world.
And that apparently is the way people are handling it more and more often. David, what are you seeing in your own practice? My read is that these eligibility changes and clawbacks have increased over the last decade and more.
Well, a couple of points. First of all, remember that we have a progressive tax system, and that feeds into this whole discussion. A progressive tax system means not only the more you earn, the more you pay. It means the more you earn, the higher the rate of taxation. So there is, to some extent, a disincentive for earning more money at the best of times. And then when you throw in the clawbacks, that makes it even worse. I mean, I had a call, I'm going to say now 4 or 5 years ago, with a classmate of mine from Osgoode who had retired from his law firm and was contemplating doing some freelance work for that law firm and was calling me about exactly this issue. He's going to lose his supplement. And I said, well, that's your call. If you decide to do some additional work, you're paying tax at an extremely high rate. And ultimately, he decided not to do the supplementary work for that reason. It just didn't make sense economically for him to spend this time, and basically it all goes back in taxes.
Okay, so we see that right away. Now, who can explain the difference between that for somebody who kind of is doing a portfolio of work and is somewhat retired versus somebody who's an employee?
Well, I'm not the economist or the lawyer, Libby, but from reading the C.D. Howe report, it sounds like the first $5,000 you earn if you're collecting GIS goes untaxed. But after that, the rates go up substantially and the GIS clawback kicks in, thereby making up to 75% taxes on that income. So I'll let the economist and the lawyer talk about that. But that really disincentivizes them from working. And that's going to be forcing groups like CARP to come back and say, we need a higher GIS because of inflation. And we'd rather people be able to work and pay for their own needs than relying on the government.
So, and where is that clawback? Where is it clawed back?
After their first $5,000 in income.
No, but where is it finished?
Like, I don't have that.
David, do you know offhand?
No, not off the top of my head. It's progressive. The more you earn, the more they take back.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's why is it that seniors are getting the hardest hit with this, say, versus people who are precariously employed, Moshe?
Well, I think because the idea is that the GIS fundamentally is to top up old age security, right? So that's not going to apply then to people that are not already on old age security. They're going to have their own programs that they're being subjected to. The GIS, I think, clawback is about 50%. So for every extra dollar you earn, you're losing 50 cents in GIS. The logic, let's not forget, Libby, though, is that it's to ensure that everybody has some basic level of financial assistance, right? So if you have the means to go out and earn that basic level of financial assistance on your own, the government's saying, well, then you don't need this program. And so 50% is, of course, extremely steep. Like I said earlier, you can think of it as an additional tax rate. But let's not lose sight of what the program is for in terms of keeping pace with inflation. Absolutely, it should, because, again, we're trying to make sure that people on OAS have the basic level of income to meet their basic needs. And that's the purpose of that program. But the logic of it, at least in clawing it back, is that if you choose to work, then you don't need this program. But I agree that it does create these really perverse incentives that actually can make people more reliant on GIS than working beyond 65 or 67, as most businesses would ask.
And I think that's what the C.D. Howe is getting down to, is that this disincentive is going to hurt the Canadian economy because it takes folks who could be working, contributing into their late 60s, 70s, or beyond, and they now stay out of the workforce because the government's saying, we're going to punish you for doing that work, and you'll be working literally for free.
Okay, well, let's take a call from Pat in Toronto. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Libby. I could comment on all of this, but it wasn't because I've been a tax specialist, CPA, for 52 years. It's not as bad as they're saying. Tax rates used to be 63% back before tax reform. Anyway, what I was phoning about was the issue of how the federal government claims they are going to reduce the labor force or the cost of the labor force. And I think we've clearly been played in this one, because most of the people who are going to take advantage of this early retirement, let's give you an incentive to leave the federal government, are already probably fully entitled to their 70% index pension. So what is happening, maybe there's going to be as much as a 30% saving. but I doubt it. And I mean, what we all really need is the index pension. And I wish you would have a program to show what our MPs and now MPPs are getting as far as entitlements. I mean, I find it criminal that they're going after, the Conservatives are going after Carney because he was successful in the private sector. But please show Mr. Poilievre's entitlement to pension after 20 years as an MP. It's horrendous. So, but my issue is we've been played with regard to the savings of the cost of labor at the federal government.
Okay, well, I would agree with that, though it is kind of off topic. But before we wrap things up here on this particular topic, I want to get a bit to the politics of it, because I think the taxpayer-funded generational strife says, okay, you boomers, you older Canadians, you're richer than younger Canadians, and we need to take your money.
The way that groups like Generation Squeeze frame it is that all the younger Canadians' problems will be solved by transferring whatever money's going to seniors to their pet projects. So it's a Robin Hood, take from one group, give to another, and it doesn't answer the questions of a struggling economy, no housing available, all the things that younger Canadians are facing. Those won't be solved by going after old age security. There is necessarily going to be more money spent on OAS because there are more seniors. And guess what? The next generation of millennials, there's more of them. So what CARP is fighting for is to protect old age security, not just for the seniors today, but for that generation who's feeling squeezed now. We want them to feel that they have an OAS to look forward to in their retirement.
Anthony, you were also referring to, before we went on air, to loopholes. Just a quick hit on that. Are there loopholes in this that have to be closed?
Yes, yeah, certainly a conversation about the highest earners, those who are really wealthy and work with their accountants to show an income that allows them to maximize their old age security. And I don't think any senior would say that's a great way to fund retirement by giving $8,000 to someone who has millions of dollars in liquid assets. We're not talking about real estate holdings or their home or their family cottage, but if they have millions of dollars in investments and they can claim $90,000 in income annually, they still qualify for full OAS. So I see there's room to close those loopholes on the highest earners, but cutting the way that Generation Squeeze had framed it, they wanted to cut all the middle class seniors who rely on OAS, and that I'm glad the government didn't listen to them.
I mean, how many people would have those loopholes? Because if your savings are in your RIF, you can't do that.
No, but if you have investments it's generating income and you have large liquid assets. But I think the number we had was less than 6% of Canadian seniors earn more than $100,000 a year. So it's a pretty small group. And I think there's great policy work to be done on closing those loopholes.
David, what's your view of that?
Every loophole closed is more complications to the Income Tax Act, which is currently bigger than phone books used to be. So there's a lot of call for tax simplification, simplify the Income Tax Act, but you can't do that without getting rid of all of these provisions designed to deal with a very specific situation. So there's pros and cons to that side of the argument. It's debatable whether or not it's worth the pain.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to give the last word to Moshe Lander. What do you think?
Well, let's not think that these loopholes were put in place merely because the government had nothing better to do on a Friday afternoon, right? That's because of effective lobbying from various groups that want some sort of protection or feel that the existing regulations were unfair to them. So the removal of that is merely going to trigger a response from the people that were being protected in the first place. And what we find in general is that within any election, which group is most likely to vote, it's seniors, it's retirees rather than young people. And So the system is always going to try and lean to protect them, even where we're talking about a particular policy that might not have worked in their favor. And as was already cited, today's working cohort is next cohort's retirees. And so even if you're looking to go after the current group, there's always somebody waiting in the wings to say, well, I'm going to take up the banner and run with it. So I think that it's a very difficult position for government to try and find their way to remove these loopholes. And of course, the administrative cost is something that they're looking to try and reduce. So why create administration to reduce something that already is not working properly?
Well, governments love creating administration. Final, like, yes or no, Anthony, is this a win? This whole angle, is this a win for Generation Squeeze or for CARP?
It's certainly a win for CARP. We said hands off OAS. That was our campaign leading into the budget, and the hands were off. So good win for CARP.
Okay, let's wrap things up. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to talk about this budget. Thank you so much, David Rotfleisch, Anthony Quinn, and Moshe Lander. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Libby. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, and speaking of generational change, wow, what happened in New York City last night? We'll talk about those U.S. elections when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, speaking of generational change, a 34-year-old Democratic socialist has won with his platform, and he is now the new mayor of New York. Zoran Mamdani is just one of the big Democratic victories last night. What do you think of that? The numbers 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now let's go to Matt Wiley, a Republican political strategist and founder of the Wiley Strategy Group, and Dr. Chris Cooper, political science professor at Western Carolina University. Hello, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, well, let's begin with Matt. So his victory was predicted. How do you explain it?
You know, he ran a campaign that just, he talked about issues in New York, and the affordability issue is one that continues to resonate with voters. You know, I think in a way, you know, he ran a campaign very similar to what Trump did. He talked about affordability. Trump didn't talk about affordability, but he talked about, you know, making lives better for everyone. You know, Trump talked about golden age for America. Mondami talked about just making New York City affordable. And it helped that he was running against Cuomo and some other candidates just were never going to get enough votes. And, you know, I think it's an interesting lesson for Democrats on how they can win races in the city. But, I, you know, it's also a great victory for Republicans because we're going to use him as our foil all year long.
One of the things, Dr. Cooper, is that his very anti-Israel stance was a very key part of his platform. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it is interesting too, right? So I was actually talking to my students this morning about this race, and a few of the college students said, now, what the heck does foreign policy have to do with being mayor of New York City? And I got to admit, I was kind of stumped at how to answer that question. I think you're absolutely right. It did become a major part of the campaign and of the election. But at the same time, I don't know that the mayor of New York City could do many of the things that he was arguing he could do, much less would be anything to do with foreign policy. So I think it's probably a good lesson about just how nationalized our politics are. And I think to Matt's point about the Republican Party going to use Mondami against him, I mean, obviously he's exactly right. And I think that's because we're in such a nationalized environment. Here I am in North Carolina talking to somebody in Canada about an election that happened in New York City. The days of regionally consequential and isolated campaigns are over.
Well, a couple of things with all of this. So first of all, he's promised a lot of things. subsidized groceries and free transit that he may not be able to pay for in the state of New York. And who's he going to blame if that does not materialize, Matt?
Yeah, I think... Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. Did we just lose...
Oh.
Go ahead.
Okay. I can hop in. It's Chris. Who's he going to blame? I think is a great, great, great question. And, I think it remains to be seen. My guess is he's going to blame the Republicans because that's the game that we play in the United States, right? When Democrats fail, they blame the Republicans. When Republicans fail, they blame the Democrats. I don't think there's going to be a time for introspection coming anytime soon with any of these candidates.
If I could jump in on that, I think absolutely correct. But I also think he's going to blame the governor. I think we're living in a society where it's really more about who gets the blame than sometimes even the successes. And so his success as a mayor is always going to be who is standing in his way. And it might be Trump because Trump's going to take away funds or end congestion pricing, or it might be Hochul because they're not going to allow him to raise taxes or do any of the things he needs to do. His success doesn't necessarily depend on what he's able to do, but who he can pin the blame on so that he can continue. And that sort of seems to be the trend that we're going everywhere in politics here.
A couple of things. So one of the things that's cited in this victory is he got a lot of young people out to vote. He's a charismatic guy. He's 34 years old. And the other thing I keep hearing is that if there had been better opposition, Andrew Cuomo is disgraced, had to leave in disgrace after a bunch of sexual harassment things, and he also covered up the true situation of COVID when he was in the governor's mansion. And Donald Trump, who is quite hated in New York, told people to vote for him.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think if in some ways, though, what this illustrates to me is the power of the primary, right? If the vast majority of these general elections are foregone conclusions before we even know who the candidates are, then all the action is in the primary. So if you're trying to understand exactly what leads to somebody like Mondani gaining election, I think you have to actually go not just what happened last night, but what happened in the primary. I mean, the reality is they could put up anybody as a Republican in New York City and they're going to lose, right? And only in New York City and in Connecticut do they not have so-called sore loser laws. So in 48 states in the country, Cuomo couldn't have even run again, right? Because he would have been not allowed to do that by state law. So the action is in the primary. And I think that's what folks need to remember as we look towards 2026. Yeah, November is going to be important. But what really matters is what happens in March and what happens in April.
I mean, this guy calls himself a democratic socialist. And certainly in the United States, socialist is a pretty dirty word. Would you say, Matt, that the Democratic Party is now what most Americans would consider way, way on the left? And how will that play in the rest of the country?
I mean, as a Republican strategist, I sure hope they are way, way to the left. It makes our job easier going into the next election cycle. You know, I think it's interesting in politics, we like to just try to do what the last winning campaign did. And I think about Mondami, he can only succeed in the cities. That model is not going to work anywhere else. If you just look at New Jersey and Virginia, the way the Democrats won last night had nothing to do with the way Mondami ran. They were very, very localized on how they were able to drive their turnout. But in the cities, it's a different story. And I think as a Republican, we're going to spend a lot of time making him the face of the party. And I think that's to some extent why Trump actually endorsed Cuomo, was because he knew that would probably hurt Cuomo in New York City and then give that edge, because Mondami only won with a little over 50% of that vote. And so getting that foil, getting that person that and that platform to run against as Republicans is a gold mine for us. You know, and it's in the same vein as what Republicans are doing with redistricting and some of the other activities we're doing to try to change the way voting patterns are going to happen in 2026 to try to keep the House and the Senate. I think Mondami is a gift for Republicans in that sense. It's a disaster for New York City, but it's a gift for Republicans.
Yeah, it seems like a conspiracy theory to say Trump wanted him to win. So, Dr. Cooper, what do you think?
Yeah. You know, I don't know that I would go quite. I mean, Matt's making a lot of good points. I don't know. Look, first of all, I can never read what Donald Trump's thinking nor anybody else. I doubt he really wanted Mondami to win, but I think Matt's point in general is a really good one, that in a nationalized political environment, this is not going to be taken as a one-off by the Republican Party. They are, I think as Matt said very well, going to try to play Mondami as the face of the Democratic Party. So now the Democrats are going to have to do a little bit of a tightrope walk, right? They're going to have to say, hey, look, we support Mondami. We're glad he won. We're excited about the youth activism, but please don't try that in South Carolina. Please don't try that in Oklahoma. Please don't try that in Wyoming. So okay. It's going to be an interesting tightrope.
Okay. That's all the time.
That yesterday.
Sorry, we are totally out of time. We're going to be talking about this again soon. Thank you so much, Matt Wiley and Dr. Chris Cooper. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And that is all the time we have for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today. Follow us on YouTube and Instagram as well.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.